Well, that's the thing about the podcast now with people are getting very, what I've heard some of the feedback has been that people are getting very used to seeing video components now to podcasts as opposed to just hearing audio, which means the standard is now, well, if there's not a video there, then what's the point?
Bar's going up. Yeah.
It's kind of cool and kind of interesting. But yeah, the FinTech Flow, where two former accountants, one active, one inactive, discuss all things finance technology from accounting in an entrepreneurial business owner lens. We have evolved, and the show has evolved with us. And I think the modern era is defined on how well and how quickly people and businesses can iterate. So one of the things I was thinking about of things that iterate is like, where along the entrepreneurial journey with Flowcast did you have to start hosting and actively speaking? And like, how long did it take you to kind of get comfortable doing that? Like, obviously, you're starting off the business. You're just kind of focused on the business, right? Grow, get the sales. But when did you have to start stepping into this sort of thought leadership role?
Great question. I did not see that coming. We didn't prepare for this at all. But actually, that's a super interesting story, I think, for accountants as well. So in starting Flowcast, I hated public speaking. And I even hated speaking like in a meeting. I was not, I just got nervous and I didn't like, there's no, you know, it seemed like a high risk, low reward proposition at any given point in time. So when I started a company, I knew I'd have to raise money, give presentations, like go on sales calls, do all that kind of stuff. And so I just went to Toastmasters. Like it's, if you're not familiar with it, Toastmasters is a club where you can do public speaking. And it's like a group of people who all think they suck at public speaking getting together. So it's a really low pressure environment to like get used to it and get better at it. And people get really into it. And there's like all these Toastmasters chapters. And then they have like a competition and there's like an international Toastmasters presentation competition stuff that goes on. And so I started going to that and realized I'm not as bad as I think I am. I learned a lot about myself basically and ended up making me a lot more confident in my ability to speak publicly. And what I realized is as long as I'm just talking and I'm being myself and it's a subject I know, like I'm fairly good at it, pretty engaging, somewhat interesting, and I'm fine. And so I kind of leaned into what I'm good at, which is that I'm really bad and I just still can't do it well, and I don't know why, but I cannot read stuff in front of people. And it's like kind of embarrassing. It's like a little, I really, this whole looking down and looking up, and for people on video, you can see me doing that. I just like lose my place and I get all nervous and stuff. So I'm still not good at that. Like the way you read off a teleprompter blows me away, man. That blows me away. I could not do that. But if it's accounting or the Dodgers or whatever, and I'm up in front of a room of people, I don't get nervous anymore. I love talking about it. And one of the lines in Toastmasters that really helped me with that is it's like, okay, you get up to speak. Almost everyone in the room is afraid to be doing what you're doing, speaking. And you shouldn't get nervous because the crowd wants you to do well. No one shows up to a session being like, oh, I want to see this person suck and I hope it really isn't good and they embarrass themselves and stuff. So like everyone in the audience is scared to be you and they're really rooting for you because they don't want to have showed up to a presentation for no good reason. And so that kind of helped flip my mentality of like, yeah, that's right. Like no one hears. And if I mess up, so what? Make fun of it and then move on with your life and go from there. It's really easy. And so, yeah, good question, man. But no, it's something I hated it. It actually took like good concentrated effort. But I went to like 5 or 6 sessions and just got more confident and realized what I'm good at and do that.
And when did you start that?
Immediately, 2013.
Okay.
Yeah. So I quit my job at the very end of 2012, started working on this in 2013, and it was right out the gate, I realized I am not comfortable with this, but I'll have to do it.
Yeah.
It's really healthy and it's good for all aspects of life, man. I couldn't,
sure.
If you don't like public speaking, I cannot recommend Toastmasters enough. It's awesome.
That's terrific. Yeah. And I think being authentic is the key there. Is when you're just your authentic self and you feel confident about the subject that you're talking about, everything else you can just kind of let flow easy.
Yeah.
I've always been hyper conscious over every single thing that I say. And I think it kind of stems from like childhood stuff, but we won't get into that. But it's like, but it is one of those things where I'm like over analyzing. I want everything I say to be a quotable moment, but then that kind of makes it come off as less authentic. So for me, I've been working on retracting back, which is why I do so well off a teleprompter, because I'm very deliberate about the things that I wrote on there and delivering them the way that I envisioned in my head I wanted to deliver them. And then it comes to the moment. And if I don't have that script in front of me, sometimes I'm like, oh, well, what if I don't deliver this in the best possible way that I could have done it?
Yeah.
But I'm working on getting out of my head on that.
That's interesting you say that, because the way I do PowerPoint presentations, like at Flowcast Go, I go through all the slides and I generally have like bullets, or I try to have a story per slide. And the stories are the things I really don't want to forget to go on. But sometimes I forget a point I might have had during practice. And it really is when you see me do a PowerPoint presentation, like the framework is going to be the same, but no two presentations are ever the same. And I oftentimes get off all hands meetings and I'm like, oh crap, I forgot to say that thing. You know what I mean? But like, whatever, if I was distracted trying to look at every point along the way, it wouldn't go as well. So yeah, it's kind of like a, you know, you want to practice a little bit, but the idea of practicing for an hour presentation feels like a big waste of time. So I kind of,
for sure,
ease my way into it.
So yeah, one of the ways that we're iterating this and not going too far off, but you could always pick something up on the next thing is iterating the flow, fintech flow, into being this more evergreen and more, you know, there's topics that are relevant right now, but they will remain relevant. And so we're just going to, I think, continue with that trend of like, what's something that's happening overall in the industry? You're not going to find out about breaking news, but you'll get that analysis here.
Mm-hmm.
And so with that being said, let's get flowing. What's going on, everybody? Welcome to the FinTech Flow. As mentioned during the introduction, I am Drew Carrick. I am the active CPA between the two of us.
And I'm Mike Whitmire, co-founder, CEO of Flowcast, inactive CPA.
So I wanted to just kind of run through this gauntlet here of things to get up to date with everything that sort of happened over the course of the last month and news from 2024 and how it's impacting the accounting industry and finance industry and just tech sector as a whole. So this is the, in case you haven't heard, rundown. So TikTok is the closest it's ever been to getting banned. And it's amazing how many people I speak to that haven't actually heard about that news. And I feel like I'm
really
plugged in here. But wow. I think we come, being in Los Angeles, I think we're very plugged into these things that are happening in real time. Also, part of our job is to stay up to date on the news and what's happening and trends in society. I'll call my mom back east, and she's like, I had no idea that was happening.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
There was a big court case about with real estate, where now brokers, real estate agents, I don't know if you heard about that one, where
I heard all about it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Where now all of a sudden the sellers are not supposed to be, or not necessarily supposed to be, paying the buyer's agent the same way that some of the structures were in the past. I mentioned that. She's like, I had no idea that case was existing, right? And these just things that I'm staying up to date with, but there is something to this, in case you haven't heard, rundown.
Cool.
But yeah, so the TikTok thing, we'll see how that pans out, but this is the closest it's ever been. It would be an economic shakeup for a lot of people who have built their careers off of the TikTok world, and a lot of businesses who have built entire marketing strategies based off of online digital marketing and TikTok. I think you pivot it to maybe just being an Instagram thing, but it is interesting that TikTok's being gone after there.
Yeah. Yeah. And the only bipartisan thing we've had in a while.
Yeah.
As well.
Something everybody can agree on, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
I would welcome it because it's just one less platform to have to deal with. And as a digital creator,
it's less work. That's your perspective on
yes.
it. I like it. I do wonder what the argument around, a lot of people have built their livelihoods on it, all that kind of stuff. I wonder what that number actually is. Because, I mean, if we're talking, you know, I mean, no offense, and you got to think about things like macro and, you know, statistics wise. But if we're talking 10,000 people, is that, no offense to those 10,000 people, but is that worth like making a national security decision based on 10,000 people having built a life on TikTok?
As we would say, immaterial.
Yeah. Unfortunately, immaterial when there are 330 million people in the United States. Yeah. So the
next thing that we have going on here, I'm sure you've seen this, but the federal prosecutors asked the judge to require Sam Bankman-Fried to pay $11 billion and get 40 years in prison.
Oh, I did not see that. Let's go.
So we'll see how that pans out. So they asked for 40 years. His team asked for 6.5 years. So the over-unders being set somewhere around 32.5.
Okay. Yeah. Nice. And it was the, and stop me if you don't know, but it was like the Southern District of New York who took on the case?
I'm not sure who actually took on the
case. I'd be curious. Because like, my understanding is they never lose. And if that's what they're going after, he's in a world of hurt, because that's a big ask. 40 years in prison, $11 billion.
Mm. I saw his first, the first pictures of his mugshot from when he was like lined up. It's like the only picture anybody's seen of him in prison or whatever. And he's next to a bunch of these like really big, just scary looking dudes. And you just see this frail, like kind of computer nerdy type of guy sitting in there. Other thing which I thought was pretty fascinating is Liquid Death closed a $67 million in strategic financing deal, including top distributors, and they have a $1.4 billion valuation.
I just found out that's not a coffee brand.
Really?
I thought it was coffee. It's water?
Mm-hmm.
All right.
This is
$1.4 billion for water. Good for them. Good for them. A clinic in branding, as you put in the comments.
yeah. I mean, absolute. I mean, and the way that they did it is because they targeted, they designed this water to be like, one, we're going against the whole plastic movement because that's always kind of under fire. So they're going with regular cans.
Mm-hmm.
It's cooler. Literally, there is something to be said about things being cool, and everything goes in cycles. There's functionality, but there is something cool about holding a can at a concert as opposed to holding a water bottle. Also, you have a water bottle, sometimes there's a perception that you're getting involved in some recreational activities, which is why you have a water.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
You're not drinking, mm-hmm. right? Whereas this is kind of like, it just fits in, and it feels, it's designed, they marketed it really well to, monster truck shows and tattoo artists and like rock concerts, motorcycles. It created this aura, and the branding just aligned so well with how like the artistic graphics of the bottle is even presented and who they presented it to, and then the reasons of why those people would be ones who are particularly interested in this. And they did a phenomenal job. And I mean, for a $1.4 billion valuation on a company that started not too long ago in 2024 that's selling water is pretty insane.
It's super impressive. Do you know when they started?
I'm not sure exactly when they started. Was it 2017, 18?
I feel like I started seeing them a few years ago.
Yeah.
Whatever. That's really, really impressive.
And now they've expanded into different flavors of water, sparkling water, and they've got an iced tea as well. And so they're really leaning into it. And they, again, it's called Liquid Death because it's supposed to sound more aggressive. At the end of the day, it's just water. But if you drinking it, you're like, I'm not drinking death, I'm drinking life.
Yeah, I, that's why my take was this is like really intense coffee, like double X nitro cold brew or something to that effect. But mm-hmm. it's water. Get you hydrated. Yes. Stay real hydrated. That's good.
Death by Coffee is a coffee that I have drank, which is double the caffeine type coffee. So there is something to that.
You're still here.
Yeah, I'm still here. Other kind of exciting news is PBC season 3 is wrapped.
Very exciting. Congratulations. You guys worked very hard on that one. So awesome work.
It's really cool analyzing it from like being a former public accountant to then being a current producer and kind of just the overlaps of the busy season comparison. The only difference is this time we're on our feet all the time.
Yeah. That is very different. You never get to sit.
Right. Mm-hmm. You don't get to sit at all. You're running around back and forth. You're putting out fire drills versus, busy season for accountants is kind of more so. You're sitting down at the desk. You're just chugging away. You know exactly what you have to do, and it's just a matter of there's this immense amount of work and how are we going to get it done. This is kind of like you're figuring it out on the fly. Like, there is an immense amount of work. How are we going to get it done? But you're figuring it out in real time. It's not just putting in the hours.
It looks it looks like fun, but also exhausting. Like, you guys work really hard. So awesome job doing that.
Yeah, so the link to our youtube.com/flowcaststudios will be in the bio to this. And if you haven't seen seasons 1 and season 2, it is the show about the accounting department at a fast growth tech startup. Happens to be an AI tech company. So very timely, very, very relevant.
We nailed it.
So now the story I know you've been dying to mention. As a Dodgers fan, Shohei Ohtani is in the spotlight for all the wrong reasons now, and it just kind of highlights the importance of trust in relationships, which this theme I've been seeing pop up all over the business world of just the modern era is creating trust and building rapport, whether it's with clients, whether it's creating partnerships, it's how do you build this trust. Here's somebody who built a lot of trust and allegedly spoiled a lot of trust, but what's your breakdown here of this situation?
I wanted to put this one on here to defend the Dodgers.
Okay.
It's been really, and it's funny, I just got off a call with a customer where we were talking about this whole situation. He also happens to be a Dodger fan, is up in Utah. And we're talking about how the story is kind of changing here, right? It started a little different and then the story changed. And one of the things I'm reading a lot about it, particularly the people who hate the Dodgers, is like, how could someone steal $500,000 from somebody without them even knowing? And I think as accountants, we maybe have a unique perspective onto how easily that could actually happen. And it's really not like all that wild that $500,000 was wired out here or there and Ohtani didn't know about it. And so that's the thing that blows me away is the people with no financial knowledge are just like, how in the world could you steal $500,000? It's like, well, when it's someone who wires that kind of money regularly and it's an entertainer, athlete, they have agents, they have, wealth managers and things like that, they're not connected to their finances. And a guy like Shohei, like his net worth probably moves $5 million on a weekly basis just based on where like the stock market stands and all that kind of stuff. So he's not looking at this all the time. And then I was speaking with somebody who had a roommate in college who's from Japan, and he's a fairly rich kid from Japan and had a translator with him that just came to the United States with him. And apparently he had access to everything, like all of his bank accounts, everything. He could just go in there and update things and make changes for him, which makes sense because you can't fill out like a bank application form or you can't create a credit card thing with this. And so having the person who speaks English there to do the financing and the banking for you, like, just makes things easier. And yeah, presumably there's a lot of trust between all of this. And so that, I just wanted to hop on and just be like, hey, it's very reasonable to have that amount of money stolen from you without you knowing. Like, it's a little more common than you would think. And it's not, if you have all the financial information, the cell phone information, their email account, like, I've wired money and you can steal money pretty easily from that if you have, you know what to say. So anyway, that was it. It's a bummer to see. I hope it is true that he just stole money from Shohei and is a total sketchball and was gambling and all this stuff, and Shohei is not involved and was, you know, an innocent bystander in this whole thing. I don't know if that's, I have no idea if it's true or not, but the idea of money being stolen like this is not something that should be like out of the realm of possibility.
It's definitely not out of the realm, I think, of being stolen. The other aspect too, or what some people have kind of suggested, is that, I mean, Shohei, I mean, you just look at the picture, he's just like a good looking guy. I mean, he looks like a genuine, just,
he's the golden boy.
Like, he just wants to play baseball. I mean, like, I mean, literally all he cares about is, like, I just want to play baseball at the highest level and be the best potential athlete that I could ever possibly be. I could see if this guy is somebody he trusted, he's like, hey man, I got myself in a pickle. Can you send me $500,000 or whatever I needed? Yeah. I'm sure he would be like, yeah, sure. Like, whatever you need to take. I mean, it's almost like it's a shared piggy bank at that point. Right. And you don't know all the nuances. And so he could really get taken advantage of by somebody who's like providing that bridge service of doing the translating. It'd be kind of, I mean, imagine, you have to really trust your translators telling you the right information, is conveying it in the proper way, because nobody else has any idea what's going on. They're the only person holding that together.
Yep.
You almost need an auditor, kind of a translation auditor, kind of listening in on the conversations to make sure that everything this guy's saying true.
That's a really interesting idea. Maybe when you're of that net worth, like, anything, particularly with finances, that should be, or even, yeah, in life in general, any business conversation, making sure you're being understood properly.
And an independent translator.
Yeah, you might be onto something there, like a translator auditor. Wow, way to tie this into accounting really, really, really well. But yeah, that's fascinating. I mean, I could also see the example where your buddy got in debt, $4.5 million, and he has gambling debts, and you don't want his kneecaps to get broken. And so maybe you do agree, like, all right, man, I'll help you out this time and, like, make it go away, that kind of stuff. But that isn't certainly not what they're alleging here. They're alleging he stole all the money.
Well, unfortunately, it's illegal to help somebody out with the gambling debt, so it's safer to have it now.
Yeah, when you wire it to an illegal bookie, you are violating.
Regardless, I don't think Shohei has any actual guilt in the situation, whether he was aware or cognizant of it or not. I mean, I think he was just an innocent guy who's, whether it's helping the friend or whether it got stolen and whatnot, just has blind kind of, you know, just sort of has this trust in this person who has the ability to take advantage of him using the skills that he has. But,
well, my fantasy baseball group text, which is mostly non-Dodger fans, would not agree with you. They all want Shohei to be the sketchball who's been betting on baseball and is about to get banned for life from the sport. So yeah, that's what we're up against. That's why I want to hop in here and be like, no, money can be stolen from you at that amount.
All right.
My fintech flow soapbox. All right, let's move on on from baseball. On
we'll
to the
keep
next
going. So things happening in the accounting world, which are of interest. And it just kind of, I think that's a kind of a good segue to the amount of money, like $500,000 that we just talked about, like if you were to transfer $500,000, for all these large-scale businesses, I mean, you think about like the government being trillions and trillions of dollars in debt, and none of these things move the needle in any direction. It seems so microscopic. It's like $50 to a regular person. But obviously, there's a lot that's viewed from these PE companies when it comes to these accounting firms, because they're starting to really dump a lot of capital and investing in that. So obviously, there has to be enough to make them feel like this is a worthwhile investment. So I'm always kind of curious as to like what you think from the private equity standpoint is, because VCs, obviously, a lot of them, they have different stage startups that they'll go after with a different risk and different reward results. I'm wondering what the sort of positioning here is for a lot of these private equity companies, because this is from Accounting Today, but basically Grant Thornton got a stake from a major PE, which the PE firm is New Mountain Capital, and they took a majority stake in Grant Thornton, and it's the biggest deal to come along in the PE's involvement in the accounting field. And they're not the first, because I believe it was BDO that had also recently gotten money for the purposes of from PE companies.
Do you know the dollar amount by chance?
I could not find the dollar amount exactly. Gotcha. I do know from this is the inside information here, because I have colleagues at Grant Thornton, which is my former alma mater in the public accounting world. Apparently, a bunch of the managers and above got like 30K bonuses as part of this.
To stay?
Basically to stay.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So generally, private equity, it's like when they see a good opportunity to clean stuff up and then maybe make some acquisitions, make the company bigger, drive efficiencies via M&A and back office stuff, cleaning it up. That's the general play. But like, as we've been talking about, feels like nonstop on this podcast, the talent war, you know, there's already not enough people. So it's not like you can go in and cut a bunch of unnecessary employees, and which now, in fact, not only are you not cutting them, you're giving them huge retention bonuses to stick around. So that like makes sense to me. So then that leads me to believe they think there's an opportunity to drive efficiency in some other way than cutting a bunch of heads. And then probably we'll go on an M&A spree and start to buy other firms and combine it into one and have like this all the centralized functions a lot cleaner and tighten that up. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I think a lot of it could also perhaps have to do with the different change in the operating structure, because obviously they have a partnership model, which is what all of these accounting firms start with. And so one of the things that this article talked about is Grant Thornton will operate in an alternative practice structure with Grant Thornton LLP being the licensed CPA firm. And they'll also provide the attest services, but then Grant Thornton Advisors LLC will provide the advisory and non-attest services.
Oh, so they're splitting it. Okay.
So I think the PE firms are probably better equipped to handle dealing with the advisory and consulting type services. The people who probably work at PE come, I imagine, a lot of them from that consulting background. Let the audit partners do their thing with the audits. They'll keep managing that. That's sort of just like your bloodline. Companies need to get it. You do it. We're not going to explode our revenue from having a growing audit practice. Mm-hmm. But we know that we can perhaps implement some of our strategies here when it comes to business advisory services and all of the consulting area. That's our bread and butter as a PE company. So we'll get that really cleaned up shop and craft using your existing customer base and using your existing brand equity. We'll craft like the perfect consulting firm. And I think they're kind of viewing it as the chance to get in before the other companies do. And Grant Thornton is a huge company. It's a national, international firm, and you're never going to be able to obviously do this with the big four, but you can do it with a Grant Thornton size entity, and you have immediately this huge grasp on the whole globe.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's kind of nice because audit business is effectively recurring. You know, it's going to be there. Everyone's going to have to be audited, so that will either stay flat or grow at some sort of clip going forward. Then, yeah, you split it off here. The other opportunity, I hate to say it this way, but it is what it is. A lot of these funds, and Grant Thornton might be the same, like large pension liabilities sitting on the books. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you finagle with entity structures, if you get rid of that pension liability, because if you get that off the books, these, I think, become way more appealing companies going forward. Like, I don't even know what do you think EY is going to have to pay out partners for the next 30 years and how much of that's, you know, actually saved? What's the pension plan funding at this point? So if you can go in and buy everyone out of their pension and not have that be something hanging over your firm for the next 100 years or whatever, that can make it a lot more appealing as well.
Well, what this kind of ties back to the whole theme of iterating, and the workforce isn't the same that it used to be. It's not this, and this is straight out of the article. It talks about the idea of working for 30 years for long hours, grinding through it and being able to reap the benefits is less attractive. If you look at a private equity situation, every 5 years, those partners could be theoretically going through equity events, which could provide them the opportunity to take chips off the table. It changes the ability. And you got to think about it. People don't work at the same job for, I mean, if you last 5 years at a company these days, like that's kind of viewed as a while.
Yeah.
I mean, I would think there's so many millennials that are like 2 or 3 years at a time, 2 or 3 years jump, 2 or 3 years jump. And start a lot of the time, it starts in public, but even when they leave, it's not like, all right, I put my time in public, now I landed my job, and this is where I'm going to be for the rest of my life, which I think used to be the old model. You either stayed there, or you stayed up a certain point and then jumped and then stayed there. And with this new approach, you have to kind of address how you're dealing with the pensions, because it's not going to sustain.
You don't have to, if I remember correctly, you don't have to be there 30 years to get like the full pension benefit. Sure. You can get some portion of it, right? Like I think I'm in the EY pension.
I have a plan
for the least amount possible I'll get when I retire. But I think I'm in. Yeah. That's
right. I think this is something that was actually kind of happening a little while, and we'll end the Grant Thornton talk on this. Was like, I got it in the mail. I think it was like 4 or 5 years ago. It might have been longer than that, actually. Maybe like 6 years ago, I got in the mail from GT, hey, we're trying to kind of relieve the administrative burden of all these people who, when you hit your 3-year mark, you hit that first tier and it had been accumulating for a while. And it wasn't a heck of a lot of money, but it was still enough for me to be like, well, that's worth me staying for that 3-year mark in order to make sure I have that. And I did get that. And then they're like, well, shoot, now we don't have to manage this person's pension and all these other people. So they actually offered us a payout where it would just be completely paid out and rolled over into any other sort of plan. And so I just rolled it over into one of my 401ks.
But nice. Okay. That makes sense. And just one other thought before we leave the slide, don't drop off every 2 years.
Yep.
It is a bad look.
Yeah. Especially now, and I think it's starting to get to the point where it is catching up, especially as companies are, I think, treating employees better for the most part. And they're starting to recognize that if you just reward existing employees, you know, there's more possibility to go upward than what it was, you know, a decade ago when everybody was job hopping constantly.
Yep.
So then on to our next story here. This is coming from the government. This is the antitrust discussion that's kind of happening now with, I don't know if you heard about Apple getting threatened. Mm-hmm. This is another one of those things which you're not sure of how up to date people are on what's going on. But yeah, the government accused the tech giant of blocking software developers and mobile gaming companies from offering innovative services on the iPhone, resulting in higher prices for customers. The antitrust complaint also claims that Apple limits the functionality of hardware products that compete with its devices and makes it more difficult for users to switch devices that don't use its operating system. I mean, this is the whole green text, blue text debate essentially is where it started. And Apple claims that it's because they are, Apple claims that they're essentially using this as a way to keep privacy and we just ensure our iPhone users are able to do that. And everyone's like, there's other ways to do it. You don't need to make it this exclusivity thing.
I heard, listened to a couple segments from different perspectives that I thought were really interesting on this. And a big part of the concern is the super apps. And I'm not familiar with this, but I'm not a WhatsApp user, but apparently WhatsApp use it for, I know it for messaging, but apparently it can be used for a bunch of stuff like paying bills. And there's just like all, it's a super app that can do a lot of the things that the iPhone can do, but iPhone has it in different applications and something like a WhatsApp or trying to think of what's the version in China that they have, WeChat, WeMo, something like that. But yeah, there are these super apps where you can do a ton of kind of the baseline, like pay for the like a bunch of functionality on there. And if you're using those apps, it makes it easier to port over to different phones and you care a whole lot less about the underlying device. And so in countries that have the super apps, there's a much lower percentage of Apple being used relative to other products because you don't need this like Apple product that has everything associated with it. And so that's one approach here, the whole just like little stuff that's like the green text, the green bubble is like a little thing there as well. I know the payment challenge with Epic Games, I think, was a big part of this. Epic's the one that has Fortnite, right?
Yeah.
Someone will correct us if that's not right, but yeah, whoever has Fortnite, right, they got in this whole lawsuit around them because they want to be able to charge separately and not give the Apple Marketplace 30%, which is a lot of money to give a marketplace. Like you just got to cut 30% off the top of your revenue to go to Apple. And it's kind of an arbitrary number that they made up. That's a lot of money.
Yeah.
That's like a lot to give up and people don't have any other options. And when they try to build their own, they shut them off. That's pretty anti-competitive if you ask me. So my take on it is it's a couple different perspectives there. I don't know what to think about it. Cause I can get on board with the pure free market capitalist argument, which is like, if it's so bad for consumers, they'll start leaving Apple, using Google products. Apple will have to adjust their ways and we'll go there. I don't like actually see that playing out to the point financially where Apple would be like, oh my gosh, we're losing how many hundreds of millions of users would they have to lose before they'd like proactively give up this monopoly that they have? Or you have government intervention to come in and say, no, you can't do this stuff. Because then as the guy running a tech company, you're basically, could you imagine if the government came in here and said, you have to adjust all your roadmap to have less of a competitive advantage?
Right.
Like that would be a tough pill to swallow because you only have so many engineering resources. You want to allocate them to delivering value for your customers and making their experience better, not working on worthless stuff. And not only is it worthless, it's reducing the value of my organization. I don't know, man.
I think it has to be really carved out of what aspect of it, because it's not illegal to be a monopoly, which is interesting, right? There's obviously antitrust and making sure that you're not taking those competitive practices and using them unethically. because there is a certain point where the government does have to safeguard the public, right? And I think, like, Amazon, I think, could get to that point if they're not already there, where it's like, at what point does a company become so big that it has become so convenient, but people have become so reliant on it that they really could take advantage of the fact that everybody uses it? And I always refer to this as like the Toys R Us approach, right? Amazon just totally destroyed them by undercutting their product prices for however long it took until Toys R Us was just drained of all the money. They couldn't cut their prices any lower. Amazon could afford to take the hit, and then the competition's gone. Now you pull it back up, and now you're the only one in the marketplace. At the same time, everybody's so reliant on Amazon. So it's like, I want to shop local, but it's just so convenient to be able to just go out to Amazon and get what I need. Mm-hmm. And so there is this sort of balance, I think, that we'll have to deal with. I think when it comes to the Apple stuff, they do have this ecosystem which works very well within it, which is amazing. However, I think what they can't prevent, I guess, is that right now they're making it intentionally too difficult for other people to offer alternative methods. Like, if you have the competitive advantage because all of your things work so much better when you're in the Apple ecosystem, my Mac connects to my phone, which connects to my iPad, which connects to my TV, then you have that going for you, and that's terrific. And it should just be better than whatever somebody else can offer. But when you're not even letting people offer that alternative option, because it's just like, nope, your thing's just going to crap out if you try to use your app on our platform. That's what I think they're trying to target with this.
It's pretty similar to what Microsoft got in trouble for, not allowing Netscape on their operating system, trying to box them out so that Internet Explorer took off. It's like the idea that, can you imagine if Microsoft didn't allow third-party applications to be used on Windows? Like, so that was where they were heading, though. And right. So that's a decent comparison to make on this. And obviously, Microsoft had to open it up and allow for other people to develop on it. I have a strong hunch that's where this ends up, is they're going to probably lose this. It's probably going to take a really long time before anything changes.
Oh, yeah.
To me, though, the most interesting part of this is actually just the overall, like, antitrust theme that's going on right now. Because I think I've talked about it on this podcast before, but the one that really pisses me off is within the meatpacking industry. There's a duopoly there. And the reason meat prices went up so much during COVID is not because the price of the input into meat got more expensive. Like, I saw this great segment where they're interviewing farmers about the price of beef and all this kind of stuff. And they're like, yeah, we don't get anything extra for a cow. Like, corn costs a little bit more, but we're not being paid more. And at the grocery store, the price is going up. And so where's all that profit being had? It's in the meat processing facility. They're just simply charging more for the meat that comes out of the back end of it. And the reason they can is because there are like two of them. And then they would just be like, oh, inflation is up, and so our prices are up. And meanwhile, their profit margin is going way up through the roof through all of this. And meat is something that impacts almost everybody in our country. Like, the price of an iPhone is not the number one priority. So to me, what I was checking out, the best part of this is that Merrick Garland and they're looking at other stuff that's more impactful for our society as well. Private equity firms buying up all the apartment buildings and single family homes and jacking up rents. That's another thing that they're looking into. Sure. You know, how much can BlackRock own before that's considered a monopoly and you're just jacking up rents on people or whatever? There's algorithms that are defining fair market value, but all that is price collusion via technology. Yeah. And so it's really like the Apple thing is obviously the headline because it's Apple, but I think they're doing way more important work that will like impact the day-to-day life of people who have really been hit by inflation. Because could you imagine if the price of food and rent went down?
Oh my gosh, it would totally shift the perception of the economy.
That's it. That's it. Yeah. So that to me is the most encouraging part of this whole thing is actually there's other things they're looking into as well.
So the last thing here we have from the up-to-date section is Journal of Accountancy. This is four things that CPAs need to know about the SEC climate rule. This is essentially just, first off, it's 886 pages long, this document.
Oh my gosh.
So that's why I felt it was good to kind of just give a little summary of the enhancement and standardization of climate-related disclosures for investors, SEC release numbers. I mean, I'm not going to go through the numbers, but it provides a valuable overview of the rule, which mandates a significant set of new disclosures via both Regulation SX and Regulation SK as early as fiscal year beginning FYB 2025. And in summary, it covers what all companies registered with the SEC, including foreign private issuers, must report in SK, which is the non-financial statement, and an SX financial statement disclosures, including what a subset of registrants must report related to greenhouse gas or GHG emissions. I'm wondering if this is a new role for assurance accountants, right?
Because
the greenhouse gas disclosures will require attestation as early as 2029, and large accelerated filers must obtain limited assurance starting in 2029 and reasonable assurance in 2033, including accelerated filers must obtain limited assurance by FY 2031, won't be subject to reasonable assurance. That's a mouthful, but essentially we have to start tracking now as accountants and as auditors what the greenhouse gas emissions are, but not just like, okay, they're disclosing it, but actually ensuring that what's being disclosed is indeed accurate.
If it's an SEC filing and it's going to be audited by the auditors, the work's going to be done by accounting.
Yes.
It is what it is. So accountants, we're going to have to take this work on. For starters, I feel like a really bad accountant. I'm hoping you are in the same spot as me. This is the first time I've heard FYB.
I have not heard FYB.
Beginning. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. At least there's the two of us. All right. I don't feel...
This must be a new thing that they're trying to get to go along, which right. I've never heard of a fiscal year begin. Maybe this has to do with when regulations come out of like, well, it's depending on when it started as opposed to... I'm always used to things being like, well, if it ends, but
yeah,
maybe they're worried about people continuing to push their year end so that they don't have to adopt it.
I don't know. Interesting. But I was chatting with one of the big four firms about this recently, and they're seeing their clients have to take on this work, like the accelerated filers, more around the ESG lens, but this feels like the SEC requirements of ESG being put in place is kind of how this reads to me. It's stuff like, you know, if you're selling pineapples, you have to reach out to whoever does your trucking for you and understand how many gallons of gas they used and what the impact is, and then you put a schedule together around here's the amount of CO2 emission that was caused as a result of this gas being used and track that. And so multiply that by everything you do that has an impact on the environment, and all of a sudden you're having to do a ton of extra work for that. And yeah, if it's going to be attested to at the end of the day, it's going to accounting. So this is going to be a big change. I think the partner I was talking to says it's like on par with Sarbanes-Oxley, which was a lot of work.
Yeah, I believe
a lot of work.
This is kind of like the next iteration of what. Yeah, this is what the next Sarbanes-Oxley sort of is. And then it says like a matter is material if there is a substantial likelihood that a reasonable investor would consider it important when determining whether to buy or sell securities, or how to vote, or such a reasonable investor would view omission of disclosure as having significantly altered the total mix of information made available. Because people are going to start investing, like you said, based off of ESG, based off of greenhouse gas emissions. What's the impact this company has on the climate? And I mean, there is a monetary aspect tied to it too, of like how dangerous is this company? And there's also like the ethical portion of it too, which is just like, I don't feel comfortable investing in or being with a company that's exceeding this threshold or whatever it's decided.
I hate this line on the bottom of the slide. That this is so broad for interpretation. So it says, quote, a matter is material if there is a substantial likelihood that a reasonable investor would consider it important when determining whether to buy or sell securities, or how to vote on such or such a reasonable investor would view omission of the disclosure as having significantly altered the total mix of information made available. That to me feels so subjective. A reasonable investor in this mode, my understanding is generally a reasonable investment is made based on financial criteria that are in there and information being disclosed. This is not a financial matter per se. So how do you like arrive at materiality? And how does this help you make a financial decision? That's where it feels like you might go to emotions with some of this.
Sure.
And how do you determine who a reasonable person is? Like if someone doesn't believe in global warming and doesn't give a crap about this stuff, they're going to make the investment whether this is recorded or not, versus someone who wraps their entire life around that. That's the only thing that matters. They might care if 1 gallon of gas is being used by a company. So who's reasonable? Because I feel like today we're dealing with people at extreme ends of everything. And so who do you determine who's reasonable within that? It seems really subjective.
Well,
and where does this always go when auditors get involved? To the most conservative spot possible, which it means this is going to create so much work, man.
Yep.
This like reading of the law or the rule will create so much extra work.
Well, so I think about it like this though. Essentially, when we decide what materiality is going to be on an audit engagement, every audit firm has a different paradigm that they're using. Like there's a different methodology of how they determine. I mean, you have revenue, right?
Well, they
all start to use the same thing, right?
Yeah.
It gets to a point where everybody's kind of using the same method, you know, we're using 2% of total balance sheet assets, or we're using a certain amount of the revenue, or, and you decide that, okay, this is what materiality is for any given single line. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, it is sort of, when you get your CPA license, your job is to do good by the public to ensure that they have the information they need to make decisions. So it is, in a sense, this thing for accounts to now figure out of, in our opinion, in my opinion, how impactful would this information or lack of information be for my decision to go for this? And it is, like you said, it is very ambiguous and it's a lot of pressure on it, but it is kind of up to us to determine and decide, which is kind of cool. The thing to keep in mind is, I don't know if you know this term called greenwashing. So greenwashing is also called green sheen, and it's a form of advertising or marketing spin in which green PR and green marketing are deceptively used to persuade the public that an organization's product aims or policies are environmentally friendly.
Like how we see all the Chevron commercials about how they're investing in sustainable energy.
We need somebody to sign off and tell us whether or not this, this is another thing that's happening now. Greenwashing is when it comes to the environment. There's a lot of AI washing that's been going on with companies too, which is touting how they use AI in all these different capacities and how it's revolutionizing the way they work. And then when they don't, and they get caught having not actually used AI at all, they've used that as a marketing scheme. It's a straight up lie.
Yeah.
And so this is definitely a thing that I think we're going to hear more about, especially as we make this push to green energy and as it's impactful to more people.
Yeah. I wonder how it plays into corporate marketing, broadly speaking. That's really interesting.
But, you know, we're going to have to mm-hmm. deal with this when Flowcat,
yeah.
you know, becomes a public company and it has SEC filings, and somebody's job is going to be like the server room. How much energy is being used and where is that coming from and how much is being emitted and what's the impact on the environment?
And does that have an impact on a financial decision when maybe they, you know, from a financial perspective, what's important is how much we spend on that, not
sure
what it is that. But then there's some industries where maybe that makes a ton of sense. Like if you're a logging company, I don't know, and everything you do is by gas and based on how many trees are left, like maybe that's an industry where that could materially impact the financial health or at least like the forward-looking health of the organization. So we don't need to figure this out in real time, but maybe it's like an industry-specific yeah. thing or something.
Oh, I think
like
it definitely will.
Yeah, like it's software. I can't see how this would be like a big thing, but
no.
But oil and gas and manufacturing, I can see this starting to kick
in. But that's where you'll want to know, depending on the industry of the company it's in, you expect gas companies to burn through a lot of gas, but you don't expect whatever companies to. So you'll have to start to do, this is going to be a whole industry and a whole profession that comes yes. out of analyzing this and being an analyst. So that's at least exciting.
Totally. Wow, we got a lot to keep going.
So yeah, we got to keep crushing through this. So let's go on to our quick little bullish or bearish here. For this one, we're talking about, actually, speaking of the environment, is EVs, because electric vehicle growth will be slow in the near term, even as the long-term future remains promising, according to recent earnings reports and analysts. And it's true, the pace, so this is from General Motors CEO Mary Barra, it's true that the pace of EV growth has slowed, which has created some uncertainty when we will build to demand. So there has been this sort of overcorrection, I think, where there was this big push to EVs. All these manufacturers started being like, yes, we're going to make EVs. And then all of a sudden, the consumer market's like, well, we're not ready to necessarily buy them all right now.
Yeah.
We want to move in that direction, but we're not getting them yet, per se. And now a lot of these are just sitting on lots and everybody's kind of going for the hybrids, actually, for the most part.
Okay.
So I don't know if we kind of like, we went ahead.
I wonder what the hangup is, because this is certainly like an LA bubble thing. Everyone has a Tesla in LA. I feel like it's every other car is some form of Tesla at this point, but we have a great charging network. People don't have to drive more than 200 miles in any given day. You're commuting. And so we have some advantages around that. Do you have any sense of like why this is the case?
I think you have a couple things happening. And one of the things is that a lot of these modern plants are starting to go to more remote areas, where the manufacturing that's coming back to the U.S. is going to, I don't know, places in Ohio or Indiana or something yeah. like that. Northwest Arkansas, I heard, is actually like a hot spot right now.
Nice. Okay.
And so anyway, so it's cool because we're starting to expand and like we're not over condensing these cities, which is great. However, a lot of these places, just their grid is not prepared.
Yeah.
To have all of this energy suck. And we really just are in a situation where, in theory, we like it, but we just don't have the energy source in place and the infrastructure to actually provide energy for all these EVs. And I think that just creates a lot of people get scared. And they're like, well, what if I can't get my electric car charged because there's just not a place for me to do it, or I run out and I'm just stuck here and I can't just have someone come with a tank of gas and just fill it up so I can get the rest of the way home.
Yeah.
And the other aspect is actually, and this is just sort of now, you know, EVs are such a, still a new thing, you know, relative to the grand scheme of everything, where you're starting to see this adoption curve based on how the different climates affect it. And there's a whole issue with cars that were in the cold and the batteries aren't working properly.
Mm.
So yeah, I think in the long term, I'm still bullish on the EV market, but I think right now we're just going to go through this sort of phase where, and I kind of am correlating it a little bit to the EV market, where in relation to the overall tech world, I think EVs are almost viewed more as like tech than they are viewed of like this American grit
sort
of manufacturing thing. And I think Tesla sort of created that, where you're driving a piece of technology, you're not driving a vehicle, a motor vehicle.
Well, they're little wussy electric cars that don't go bah,
right,
that whole thing, which like people love cars.
Yep.
I get that. But I think on a practical level, if you're not buying a Tesla, it's so hard to have a charging network that like makes sense. If you're looking at Chevy, you know, EV or something to that effect, like unless Tesla allows you to go and start using their charging stations, they've invested so much in all of that. So like with a Tesla, it's not a problem being able to supercharge somewhere and it's a piece of cake. It requires a little bit of behavior change, and people can be scared of behavior change, but once you get used to it, I promise it's not a big deal. But yeah, if you have one of the other brands where you don't have a network, it's very reasonable to be like, oh, well, what if I get stuck somewhere and how am I going to get there? And,
yeah,
and how can I go on a road trip and all that kind of stuff? But like, if you're in an area like us, like I'll tell you, I drive my Tesla to Vegas, I drive it to Phoenix, I drive it to the Bay Area. Like I go on these long road trips and it's really not a problem at all with all of it. So am I bearish or bullish? I think that we're also looking at these sales numbers in the middle of an economy where people who would be buying these cars have, you know, the highest credit card debt that's out there. There are massive interest rates. So this is like a thing that maybe it's not a like EV market thing. Like I wonder if we look at across cars broadly, if sales are down because people are just not buying the newer model and are hanging on to their last car for a little bit longer because of how tight things are right now.
Sure. Yeah.
So I don't know. I guess, short-term bullish or short-term bearish, long-term bullish.
Yeah.
Where I'd be on that one.
That's pretty fair.
Agreed. What about you? Is that where you're at?
Yeah. No, that's where I'm at. And like I said, I think also it has to do with the tech market, right? But if you're viewing it as tech, like tech as a whole sector, right? I mean, we've seen it sort of plateau from the boom that it was. So I think people were very hyped on new tech, right? And you're rushing in, you're like, I want to get the new EV. Now all of a sudden it's kind of like as the tech has sort of like flattened out a little bit for a moment, and we're seeing who's going to be the people that withstand and then take the next growth up, who's the ones that are going to kind of fall down because they were just all hype. Just kind of, it plays along with that. It tracks.
Well, I think we talked about it in this podcast, and I wish I could remember who it was, but the CEOs of one of the competing car manufacturers got on CNBC and said that he couldn't compete with Tesla.
Mm.
And it's like, so what they're gonna do is not invest in that anymore. And so it's another option that's not available. So, and then you claim, oh, there's not enough demand for it when you're making an expensive vehicle that's inferior. And rather than say, I'm stopping production because I can't compete with Tesla, you just kind of blame the lack of demand as your...
I think it was that EV is the one that starts with an F.
Ford?
No. I think it was one of like the newer ones that was having...
Fisker? No. This was a traditional gas...
Oh, yeah. They said like, yeah, we're done.
Yeah. And their main thing is they couldn't compete with Tesla because Tesla built everything from the ground up and owned everything. And they had a bunch of OEM deals and had to pull together different stuff, which made things break. So I don't know.
That's true. So on to the business philosophy when it comes to that sort of stuff. What's the business philosophy behind the Digital World Acquisition Corp? I don't know if you've heard about this. This is also kind of a breaking news sort of thing. I just wanted to get into this before we jump in. Is there just really truly a market, in your opinion? Like, I don't want to go into the depth of like, so Digital World Acquisition Corp, for those who don't know, is a SPAC that was designed to, well, arguably, unethically, you're not supposed to know when you form a SPAC what you're going to go acquire with it. You're just supposed to form it and then be like, we'll find an opportunity. Apparently, this was formed with the purpose... They ended up paying off $19 million. The purpose of acquiring Trump Media, which owns Truth Social.
When was the SPAC formed? Do you know?
2021.
Oh, no. It's been around a while.
But it started acquiring it then, and it just kind of finished now. And then it just took it public.
It started acquiring
The acquisition process began in 2021 of acquiring Truth Social, which happened just, you know, shortly after it was created. And basically, they created the SPAC to just peg along with the value of, like, will Trump get reelected or just any hype around his fame, essentially. And it just pegs with his fame, essentially.
Okay.
So it's just, the Truth Social made $5 million over the last 3 years. Okay.
Oh my gosh.
And it's valued at over $4 billion. So I'm just really confused as to, like, are there just always people out there who will go and buy stuff? Because I'm just like, who's investing in this thing? Because I can't easily find the information of who owns it or who invests it. I just know that their CEO was fired. The guy who started it eventually got fired, and then whatever. Now they've gone public. But there's no revenue stream. So how are you deciding what something is valued at? And
Well, it's interesting because it's supposed to be independent. It's supposed to be a blank check company, right? So you're supposed to work with the SPAC to develop a valuation that will be reasonable to the street. And then they do the whole de-SPAC and acquire you and cut the check and everything. And then the shares start getting listed. And that's when you figure out if you got the right fair market value price,
right,
or not. And so my assumption would be on $5 million of revenue over the course of 3 years, when they actually become a publicly traded company and people can buy and sell shares within it, that stock price is going to go down pretty significantly.
So apparently that's what I'm thinking of. Like, so if I'm an owner of this and I know it's going to go down, like, why do I think it's a good idea to do this? I mean, like, there's no actual prospect of, like, making actual hard money. It's all built on speculation and hype. It should be the spec.
Yeah.
Did
they go public today?
They went public, when this episode is being recorded, they have gone public. And so,
oh my gosh. All right. So,
we'll see how this goes, but...
Well, yesterday, it closed up 35%
yeah.
the first day of trading and was up almost 8% after hours.
Because it's a hype-based stock, and that's what makes me so confused, is that there's a lot of people that I would assume are pretty smart if they're in this investment realm, but they're completely doing things off of speculation. Like, I would be so risk afraid of, like, this doesn't actually make money. This thing doesn't make money. I'm just relying on people being stoked about the future potential of, like, the presidential election or whatever else is going to happen. It's all just built off of, like, the persona. It's rather than investing in Tesla, I'm just investing in, like, how many times is Elon Musk going to end up in the news? Like, that's strictly the revenue tie.
Well, yeah, you're investing in a business, which is Truth Social here. Yeah. But that's not being done for logical financial reasons. It's like the GameStop craze, right? It's just like you get into a thing, and this one is like, my assumption is Trump supporters are buying shares.
In his
company, which is going to keep the stock price high, which is going to allow him to take out loans against said stocks and pay out big bail fees that might be required for other things. Right. So this was perfectly timed and hilarious. So last week we recorded a webinar with DFIN about going public, and we're talking about how SPACs aren't being used all that much anymore.
Yeah.
And boom.
There goes
just
one.
Gets dropped.
Yeah. So I don't know. It's just a fascinating world of, like, there's somebody who's that confident, like, look, there's going to be a bunch of people that are going to get hyped about this, so we're going to make our money from that. And, like, I mean, kudos to them, but I don't think I'd have the guts to come up with, like, even if I was to hype people up on a fake AI company, I don't think I'd have the guts to, like, raise that much money and then be like, this really doesn't have any true way of making money.
Yeah.
It's a Ponzi. That's a Ponzi scheme.
It's the greater fool concept. So someone else is going to hold the bag.
Yeah, someone else will hold the bag.
Someone else will be left holding the bag.
This is so
wild. I can't believe it's up. All right. Anyway.
That's that.
Yeah.
Anyway, we'll get into this. I think we're only going to do one here on the business philosophy thing for time's sake. Farmer-owned Land O'Lakes. Land O'Lakes used to have two 12-hour shifts in order to make 350,000 pounds of cheese per day, because the most efficient way is to keep production going. Half the group's on now, they go off, then the next half are going, and you're going 24 hours, 7 days a week, you're just constantly churning out cheese.
Makes
which
sense.
Is what was needed. This is from the Wall Street Journal. But they actually just started shifting because they can't get people to actually work these things. And so the member-owned cooperative began hiring for a handful of roles at its Melrose plant, just to kind of trial run this out, along with a few of its animal-fed facilities, that let employees choose their own start times and shift lengths. And so they pay them accordingly. You're not getting paid the same amount depending on if you could work longer, you could work less, and you could work these. The hours are still getting paid by however many hours you work, but you can now have the flexibility of picking the schedule that works for you. So it's made a little bit of a scheduling nightmare from just making sure you need every aspect of this supply chain of this manufacturing plant to have every job covered at the same time, which is very easy when it's just like all of these roles are filled by these people for these 12 hours, then they're off, and then somebody replaces them. Now you're kind of like, well, that person leaves then, and then this, we got to have somebody replace that, and that person leaves at this time, and we got to replace that in order to keep it functioning. A little more difficult administratively for the managers, but employees said they like it. Remote work sort of, you see that in the other industries, and it was possible for white collar, but it wasn't necessarily the same flexibility that came for some of these blue collar things. So, you know, is flexible work schedules a thing that you think kind of catches on? Is this a business philosophy that leaders should be kind of tapping into?
I mean, I think for remote cultures, in some way that's organically.
Yeah, it's happening.
Developed, you know, especially like really good people, they can take an hour off during the day to go to a doctor's appointment, and then they'll catch up on that work at night. And so it's like, whatever, that's totally fine.
Yeah, so I think it seems that all the prices or the cost per hour is still going to be the same, but it'd be interesting to see how, because I mean, some people prefer a night shift versus other people probably preferring a day shift.
Yeah.
But I think just overall, this just tells a tale about the, in general, like true flexibility, meaning not just, you know, you could take off when you want to take off, but actually truly changing the day-to-day operations around somebody's primary commitments.
Yeah.
And, you know, so we asked ourselves, why do we have to start at 6 or 7? Does it really matter? Does it start at 5, start at 8? Like, what does it matter? And so you know, he said, this is Dewberry from Land O'Lakes. He said, you know, we had to think about it in terms of how do we wrap the work around the employees, not wrap the employees around the work, which was the traditional way.
Yeah. That's cool. It's cool. Yeah, it feels like as a manager, it's like as long as there are people there making cheese, or butter, doing the job, then we're good to go.
It's got to be outcome. It doesn't matter if it's white collar, blue collar, it's outcome. It's deliverable related. Are we getting anything done?
Yes.
So what does busy season really mean? We're in the heart of busy season. It's coming to an end right now. Got a really cool social media content called The Great Number Crunch. It's a little news video that will be ready for the next time.
All right.
We record an episode, which will be cool. It'll be on our Flowcast Studios page on Instagram. But this is from the big four tweets. If you're going to commit fraud, just make it immaterial so I can't find it, please.
Amen.
And look, disclosure, we do not condone committing fraud of any kind. But damn, when it was busy season and you're in an audit, the last thing you want to do is find something that's going to be like, I got to pull more selections. I got to go back to the client and go ask for this. It's like, I just want to get this thing done.
Yeah, I feel this way about errors, genuine errors. I agree. Fraud, just my ethics side goes off, and I don't care how small it is. So that's a tricky one, but I agree on the errors.
But the errors for sure, because it's so common to be like, you know, we were just rushing through, like we didn't get the other person to sign off, but we knew it was okay. It's like, your policy says you got to have two people sign it. I need to see the second signature.
Yeah.
And it was those sorts of things, which should always be frustrating. Like, well, now I got to pull another 10 selections. Just make sure those ones are signed, please.
And then I'm done.
Yeah. Then this is from Mark Snedeker here. Shout out, Mark. Imagine an email finding you well. It just gives you that chuckle because it's like everybody's probably different, but like who should cater to who when it comes, I think, to sending emails.
I prefer the shorter side.
Right. Just here's the information. Go for it.
Other people want it
to be stylized.
I don't need pleasantries.
I hope this email finds you well. It's like, when has an email ever found me well? If you're sending me an email right now, I'm not well.
On vacation.
Yeah. Not well. So that kind of wraps us up here with the concluding cycle. I do have, though, a footnote to disclose as part of our concluding cycle. And this was brought to us by our comms guy, John Siegel. Shout out, John. Always keeping his eye on the pulse, especially when it comes to athletics, when it comes to sports. Ex-Jaguars employee who stole more than $22 million from the team is sentenced to 6.5 years in prison. So we talk about stealing money. I think this kind of goes beyond Shohei's translator.
Yeah. He's got nothing on this guy. It's $22 million bucks to steal. I would love. Do you know how he did it? I mean,
so
wire fraud, presumably.
So this fools the full circle. So this is a former employee of the finance department.
Okay.
For the Jaguars, pleaded guilty in 2023 in December to charges of wire fraud and illegal monetary transactions. And basically, Patel stole from the Jaguars over a 4-year period by creating fraudulent charges on the club's virtual credit card. Those damn virtual credit cards. I know Greg's got something to say about that. And then covering his tracks by sending falsified files to the team's accounting department. I mean, just when you have that inside advantage and inside knowledge, the things that you can get away with, because you could see how easy it is to get away with those things and nobody's tracking you and no one's checking up on you. Like you said, you're like, how could somebody steal this much from Shohei? How can somebody steal $22 million from an organization? Well, when you're in the finance department, you have the authority and you know what the auditors are looking for. You know what your bosses are looking for. So we're all playing this game of just check. And if you know what's being checked, then
yeah,
that's why I think the government hires former hackers to be on the team, because they're the ones that know. You hire criminals to be like, well, how would you execute this crime so I can get inside your head?
Totally. And yeah, if somebody could steal $22 million from an organization that has an accounting department, has controls in place, presumably, is auditing this stuff, why in the world can't someone steal $4.5 million from a rich guy who doesn't speak English and is in this country to play baseball and not look at his bank account?
Yeah. So my lesson, the full circle lesson. There we go. We've heard it here first, all right? So you can snap that shot. But
from a guy wearing a Dodger hat, Shohei's innocent.
if he wins the World Series, then everybody's innocent, right? But full circle here is just knowing another language is so valuable, and it comes with a lot of power, but it comes with a lot of responsibility. And when it comes to translating, that's knowing a foreign language, and you're given this privilege, and if you use it wisely, it can be greatly beneficial. This guy, by the fact that he had the second skill set, was able to get into a position where I would imagine you're making pretty good money if you're Shohei's translator, right?
Yep.
So I don't think you need to steal this, but people get greedy. Same sort of thing. This guy's worked in finance for the Jaguars. He understood the language of business. He understood the accounting and finance and how all of those controls operated. And big privilege, with great power comes great responsibility. You got to use it ethically. And in this case, the privilege was used for wrong. And so the national language or the business language, and you have the ability to speak a second language fluently, you can get away with a lot. People trust you. So use it wisely.
Yeah. You could, if not use wisely, you can go to prison for 6.5 years. So
yeah,
well done getting this guy caught. I hate this stuff.
Yeah.
Very well said, Drew.
Thank you. Yeah. So we're making lessons here for accountants. Hope everybody enjoyed today's show and have a good one.
Good stuff. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks for checking out the FinTech Flow. As a reminder, this episode is available for CPE credit, and you can get that at Flowcademy or on the Earmark app. Details are in the description below.